Before you listen to this great episode of Partner with Survivor, we'd just like to tell you about a powerful new practice tool the Safe and Together Institute has launched. Our perpetrator pattern mapping tool has been available for 10 years, but now it's available for the first time in a web-based version. What it does is really help you map perpetrators' patterns of behavior onto child family functioning, talk about its intersections with mental health, substance abuse, and other issues, address intersectionalities, worker safety, all in an easy-to-use online package that protects the confidentiality of your information and lets you wrap it all up in a neat little package, basically, to print it out and to kind of document all those different pieces of information. This is a tool that can be used by both survivors and practitioners. And for the very first time, it's available immediately online without any other prior training.
The training is embedded in this powerful practice tool so that teams that have not been trained in Safe and Together can immediately begin mapping in an effective way.
That's right. It's like having a Safe and Together coach in your back pocket is what I like to say.
There you go.
So we really encourage you to go to our virtual academy, academy.safeandtogetherinstitute.com. Check it out. You know, you can subscribe to it immediately or you can check out a free demo version for 30 days. So please reach out to us and try this new tool. Now enjoy this great episode of Partner with Survivor.
And we're back. Look at us.
We're back after like a month hiatus.
Oh boy, we've been so busy.
Yeah, so busy, and some interviews have fallen through, and we're just getting back in the saddle here. But welcome to Partner with Survivor, and I'm David Mandel, Executive Director of the Safe and Together Institute.
And I'm Ruth Stearns Mandel, and e-learning strategic manager, communications, I don't know, titles.
And today is your birthday.
Happy birthday to me.
We're recording this on your birthday. I asked you what you wanted to do on your birthday, and you said, record a podcast.
There we go.
And so we're recording a podcast, and we're joining you from beautiful Tunxus land in the east coast of the United States. The traditional owners of the land here have been the Tunxus people, who are part of the larger Algonquin nation. Mm-hmm. And we just want to acknowledge Indigenous First Nation people all over the world who may be joining us, and elders, past, present, emerging, who may be just listening in from wherever you are.
And it's raining here. Which is good.
You know, yes, we need the rain.
My plants needed it.
We need the rain. And we also want to send a shout out to our friends, colleagues, families everywhere over the world as the Delta variant surges and there's lockdowns in Australia.
Yeah.
And, we just wanted to send love and good feelings out to everybody, and safety and protection.
Yes. And so, connection.
Yeah.
Good connection.
So
awareness of our connectedness and our interdependence.
That's right. So anyway, so we're back here. This is a podcast about all things domestic violence. And if you're joining us for the first time, thank you for joining us. And if you're returning, thank you for coming back. And we talk about the Safe and Together model. We interview folks. We have taken the last year and a half and sharing thoughts and conversations Ruth and I have personally, and then bringing mm-hmm. them out into the podcast environment. And I hope mm-hmm. you've been enjoying the show. Today's show is not an interview show. Today is a conversation between you and I about shifting systems to make them more perpetrator-proof against systems manipulation. And I'm super excited because, you know, still you came to me a few months ago and said, start listing all the things that domestic violence perpetrators do to manipulate systems. And mm-hmm. and that really kind of brought that element to the forefront in our work. And I think it's so important. And we're seeing that reflected. I'm not saying it's because of our work, but you know, you're seeing series like The Trap by Jess Hill in Australia. You know, a lot of people are talking about systems manipulation. I think it's the next stage in what we have to talk about.
Yeah, I think it's a good evolution in the domestic violence field to stop focusing on the individual, right? To stop focusing on the individual family and start focusing on our collective responses, our failures in supporting survivors and holding those persons who are choosing violence behaviorally accountable. You know, you can't expect that an individual is going to respond to that level of harm and trauma when nobody around them is supporting them properly,
right?
Including their friends and family, right. Religious leaders,
right.
Advocates,
right.
Family court, whatever it is.
Right.
If everybody is adversarial to them and incapable of understanding that the danger and harm is caused by one singular person,
right?
The person who's choosing to be violent to their family and destroy their family unit, that is hell-bent on the destruction of their family unit via violence and control, then we can't truly move forward in practice. We have to really understand the ecosystems around survivors and how we are helping in concrete ways that the survivor says helps them, that the survivor reports that as being helpful or not.
And it's really consistent with what we know about trauma and how people who are violated, who are harmed, who are injured by the choice of a person, how they heal, how they respond, how they internalize or not the experience has so much to do with how the people around them respond.
Acknowledge
or deny
right.
or blame that right. person for what happened to them. That so much of that what we think about as trauma,
yeah.
we think about as being about what that one incident or what happened
yeah.
to them, what was done to them. And it's so much really about how people, who they hold accountable.
Right.
How they talk to the trauma survivor, how they talk to the person who's choosing violence or abuse.
Right.
You know, what's acknowledged as being real and valid and then how do we hold that person? How do we partner with them? That's why that language mm-hmm. is in the model. How do we partner with that person?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we intervene with that person who chooses abuse and violence in ways that are just common sense, real, compassionate, but acknowledge that these patterns are, of course, control are real.
Right.
And to recognize how they get directed at systems
mm-hmm.
and how systems become targeted, professionals get targeted by people who choose course control, and that professionals and systems have choices about how they respond to those manipulations.
They do.
And today we're gonna focus on issues around custody and access.
Yep, we sure are.
And we're hoping to do kind of occasional other episodes on other systems, whether it's law enforcement or whether it's child protection.
Yeah.
And none of these systems, if you've been listening to shows before, are siloed, and they all interact and they all matter. So we're gonna be talking about addiction and mental health fields today. But the primary focus here is gonna be on custody and access and kids in the context of course control.
Right.
And this is about patterns of behavior, just like whenever we talk about this issue
mm-hmm.
And about child safety and child best interests.
Right.
You know, and so how do you create systems that protect children's safety and well-being
mm-hmm.
from harm caused by a parent who's engaging in course control in the context of custody and access.
Right. And so we're gonna use the rubric identifying, assessing, and inoculating. So we're going to go through those to really sort of categorize the behaviors that a professional would engage in, which would allow for them to perpetrator-proof their practice in a sense. You know, nothing is ever going to be 100%. Our practice is never going to be 100%, but we definitely can start to strive for much better measures of success than what has been in the industry so far. And we really want the preponderance of our actions to benefit children and adult survivors and bring about that safety, stability, self-determination, and satisfaction that we always talk about in the Safe and Together model, because those are our markers for whether or not we've served that survivor properly. And that comes from the reporting of survivors and their children themselves. We are really trying to tie this practice back to concrete markers and concrete outcomes for adult and child survivors.
So I want to start with, so to frame that sort of that rubric you laid out, identify, assess, and inoculate. I want to kind of lay the groundwork a little bit, which is that when you look at issues of custody and access in separation, divorce, obviously, no matter, almost all these situations are difficult. You know, they're challenging, they're hard,
right. They're
even
messy.
without abuse.
They're
right?
Messy, yeah.
And there's a general idea, and it's backed up in my mind by the literature, that when possible, collaborative post-separation parenting is in the best interest of the kids.
Right.
And I think it's so important to anchor this entire conversation in that.
Right.
That collaborative post-separation parenting,
right,
when it's possible, is in the best interest of the kids.
Well, the problem is that so far, the measure of collaborative co-parenting has been measures that have been set by the court, divorced from the reality of domestic abuse, and that they have behaved as if a criminal abuser can be a collaborative co-parent.
Well, see, and this is where it's so important. Yeah, right. So this is, we're right into it. And you're going to listen to Ruth and I go back and forth about this. It's so important that really to then look at then coercively controlling behaviors, coercive control,
mm-hmm,
not just physical violence.
Right.
And look at those patterns of behavior and the harm that those behaviors do to child functioning, the functioning of the other parent.
Right.
And to measure those against how well does this stack up against this gold standard of collaborative parenting behavior.
Right.
And to really articulate how much when somebody's choosing to act in a way that's coercively controlling, and has, mm-hmm, a pattern of behavior and is engaged in over time, and that it escalates in a particular way or manifests in a particular way, mm-hmm, in a post-separation period, whether it's an escalation of physical violence, whether it's an escalation of manipulation, or whether it's targeting of the courts or child protection,
right,
or the criminal justice system, to use them to their side and advantage.
Right. That, to use them to increase their power and control.
That's right.
Right.
That has to be framed, in my view, mm-hmm, as the antithesis of collaborative parenting.
Right.
And that we have to then understand that the parent who then is pointing that out, is identifying it, is saying, I'm concerned my kids are going to be harmed, that they're engaging in protective efforts, and that their efforts are in alignment with the mandates that we expect from government, which is child safety. You know, mm-hmm, that a lot of our systems have a very specific mandate. Family courts often have this, not always, that child safety is critical or important or primary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's, you know, that if we're really using this sort of vision of course control as being the antithesis of collaborative parenting,
right,
or those behaviors, that we have to really engage that conversation if we're committed to child safety.
So how do you identify in the context of custody and access what classically has been termed within the family court high conflict cases with a lot of counter allegations, typically,
right,
you know, a lot of back and forth sort of warfare,
right,
via the lawyers in the court, about, you know, claims about character and actions taken, which the other parent, you know, says are dangerous or they object to. How do you identify?
I think one of the first things you do is you accept that that you're looking to assess not just physical violence, not just risk of physical violence to one of the parents from the other. That's a very narrow definition of domestic violence. Right. That you actually have to use this sort of concept, you know, that's been there from the beginning of looking at domestic violence. It's been made popular and clear by Dr. Evan Stark and then other people, which is coercive control, and which may not manifest at all in physical violence. And that you look for patterns of behaviors that have caused negative impact to child, partner, and family functioning over time. So not just in the last 6 months, but over the course of the relationship. You look at it beyond this relationship because somebody may be engaged in behaviors in other relationships or with other kids. And that you trust in that environment where there can be cross-allegations, that you, using that behavioral lens, you ask the question. This has been true about the model since its inception, that when I train people and say to them, they'll say, well, they both have been arrested, or both people are saying the other one's violent, or they're both abusers. What I say, tell me about each person's pattern of course control and actions they've taken to harm the kids. That's all we've got at the end of the day, because domestic violence is a behaviorally based problem. That you actually have to ask these questions. But the trick really to make it successful is you can't just look at arrests. You can't just look at physical violence. You have to look at this wider pattern of coercive control. And then you have to be able to tell the story in this family about the harm that those behaviors have created to child and family functioning. Because the harm isn't always the same. And in fact, you can have tremendous harm created in different circumstances.
So let's give some people behavioral examples, because not everybody listening to this podcast will have listened to the other ones. So let's give a behavioral example in custody and access that you've seen over and over again about a abuser's pattern of behavior, both of course, of control towards the adult survivor, harm to the family unit, and manipulation of systems.
So I want to start with something really common, really basic, and I think that's something that people don't think about very often. If you leave me, I won't give you a penny for the kids.
Financial abuse.
Well, let's not even call it financial abuse. See, this is why I want to strip the jargon away for a bit, and then come back to the behaviors, and then go back to the what it means. Go back to that. You know, being able to see it means you can identify it. Being able to see it means you can assess the harm. Being able to see it means you can inoculate yourself against the manipulation. So I want you to think about any parent who's legally responsible for their children, who loves their children, that they're saying, I'm willing to withhold money for my kids. I'm willing to not fulfill my responsibilities for my children to punish you.
For you leaving me.
For you exercising your legal right
to leave,
to separate. Free association. I've been using this phrase more recently. We believe in the right of free association. Free association means I can be with the people I want to be with. I can spend time with them. Whether it's a friend, whether it's my family, whether I want to, and I want to disentangle myself, you know, that's a standard in most of societies.
Leaving relationships safely is a fundamental right.
That's right. And so this idea that I am going to threaten to punish my own children, And so this is where you
can
start.
Can you imagine? And I want people to stop and think about
That's right. It's so simple. It's so common. But I want, that's what when we have to think about this and really kind of get it. Because I think we'll often think about this through, well, people are angry. People say things that are hurtful. And yes, we want
to. And once you're willing to deny your children financial support because you're angry that somebody left you, you're an abuser.
Well, but even then, let's, you know, if we make room for people being upset at times, but then we embed it in a pattern, you know, of willingness and ability and showing and doing it and following through. And then, and I think it's just sort of this, imagine saying that to your child, mommy's leaving daddy, or daddy's leaving mommy, whatever it is. And because I'm so angry at you know, daddy, or I'm so angry at mommy, I'm not going to give you any money for your food. I'm not going to help pay for, you know, where you're living. I'm not going to pay for your school books. I'm not going to pay for your university. I'm not going to pay for your healthcare. I'm not going to take care of you because I'm so angry and I want to make, you know, that other person pay
right.
for hurting me.
Right.
I mean, if you stop and break it down to right. that level.
Right. There's a lot of acceptance
right.
of post-separation coercive controlling right. behavior,
right.
both in the courts and by society. I mean, so many people believe that somehow it's justifiable if one partner leaves another for there to be abusive and harassing and retributive behavior.
Right.
Because we have told this story
right.
that once you're married, you're owned by another person and you're going to stay right. with them for the rest of your life till you die or till that person kills you in the case of domestic violence. So we really have to shift our thinking culturally that the health of relationships is contingent upon the behaviors of the two people living in that relationship. And if that relationship is abusive or malnourishing, all of us have the right to leave
right.
safely and without harm. All of us have the right to leave.
Right. And I think if again, if we frame that back to the needs of the children and the safety of the children, I think part of what I've seen is conversations about custody and access that include a very important part, which is about risk of escalating violence. Like we need to right. really include that discussion about
right.
in this context, since we know that separation can be really dangerous
right.
and an escalation of lethality. And in fact, sometimes separation gets associated with lethal violence when there's been no physical violence part right. of that. So that's so important. But we can't let that conversation about that risk crowd out the really essential story, which is, can we talk about, and this gets a little bit to assessment, it covers identification and assessment, can we really talk about how the domestic abuse perpetrator's behavior has harmed the children
right.
and might harm them in the future?
Right.
And I think that a lot of times we're still struggling in these questions about custody and access, just like we've had in child protection, which is seeing the domestic abuse issue as a relationship-based issue mm-hmm. that ends with the separation physically or legally of the couple. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely, that's absolutely mm-hmm. incorrect as an assumption.
Yeah.
It may change the dynamic. It may make it worse.
Yeah.
It may make it better. Like, right. but to assume that's no longer a child safety issue or an issue relevant to the court.
Right.
You know, when you're looking at family court decisions is very, not only potentially dangerous at a level of lethality or dangerousness, but dangerous to making good decisions. And one of the things that I think is so important we're looking at assessing is and then inoculating yourself is really understanding particularly the pattern of behaviors that somebody may engage in post-separation mm-hmm. involving or being targeted at courts or other systems.
Right.
And I think, again, you know, when we're looking at factors to consider, that has to be explicit. See, a lot of these things, when I think about this at this point, I think about these kind of eight things. You're getting a lot of lists today. You know, we talked about three rubric of identify, assess, and inoculate. And now I'm going to talk about these eight things. But sort of, we need to be able to talk about violence and abuse.
Right.
We need to be able to talk about coercive control. Mm-hmm. We need to be able to talk about, has this person who is, are we looking for somebody's involvement in markers? Did they get arrested? Have they had orders of protection against them? Mm-hmm. You know, have they been, you know, the target of a child protection case?
Right.
You need to look at sort of this idea of dynamic factors around post-separation behaviors and targeting the courts as another factor.
And when we say targeting the courts, we mean really specific things. We mean using the courts as a tool of terror
right.
in post-separation coercive of control to bludgeon a co-parent into complying with things that co-parent really doesn't need to comply with, but that the person who's choosing to use that system wants to force them into a position of being subjected to their power and control, which is not much of a change from when they were right. together anyway. They're
well,
just And it's incredibly traumatic. When you leave a situation where you've been experiencing coercive control and domestic abuse, to have the official system, right, behave in a way that supports that perpetration is really, it's a mind bender. It's a mind bender, and it's incredibly traumatic. It's incredibly traumatic.
And this is where other systems quickly get involved. So I've kind of partway through the list here. You know, we're kind of taking a pause here. No, we're taking a pause through about four of the eight things. But I think you're right. But it's this is where, you know, you want to start thinking about other systems, which is, I'm going to call child protection on you. Right. So there's a case against you, right, and that I can then bring as evidence into family court. I'm going to make false allegations in that, right, in that court. And there was a 2005 Canadian study that showed that that was those kind of false allegations in child protection were primarily made by non-custodial parents.
Right.
Okay. Against custodial parents.
Right.
You know, these were things that were deemed to be fabricated for the purpose of manipulating system versus a genuine concern that wasn't kind of borne out that,
right,
but for that kind of thing. And right, then, you can think about, taking somebody who is, sought out mental health or addiction help and then using that,
right,
to paint them summarily as being a bad parent,
right,
or not capable.
And a lot of times that mental health and addiction help arises in the context of domestic abuse.
Well, we know that.
That you're more likely to be needing
those services,
right,
if you've been a victim of abuse.
Right.
And so the thing I like to say is a lot of times these things that are going on with that domestic violence survivor, systems participate in decontextualizing them from the pattern of abuse and the harm caused by that person choosing violence.
Right.
And so one of the ways, now we're jumping to a little bit to the end, one of the ways you inoculate yourself against being manipulated by domestic abuse perpetrators in the context of custody and access is that you really understand and keep recontextualizing what's going on,
right,
to the history and pattern of abuse. It's not history, even if it's separate. And I just was presented a case that was the couple had been separated for 8 years, multiple years, and while there hadn't been any physical violence, there was ongoing manipulation of systems, and that had been invisible until very recently.
Mm-hmm.
And then using the mapping tool and a really dedicated professional, you know, that it led to protection of the kids through a reversal of orders, because without the context, the victim parent was looking poorly.
Right.
But once you put it back in context, what was looking as poor behavior starts to look more rational,
mm-hmm,
starts to look protective. And right, this is why for me, so much of this conversation about refusal and resistance, you know, in family court is has to really live inside this conversation about, first, are you doing a good job? Is your court system doing a good job comparing the behaviors of domestic abuse perpetrators against this gold standard of collaborative parenting?
Right.
And doing a thorough assessment of the pattern of behavior and the harm it's created for child, partner, and family functioning.
So
I sound like a broken record after, because so, if you've been listening, you hear
you
me say
the
this
same over, thing over and over,
over
again.
And over again, but we see the impact it's having on these decisions.
I guess, okay, my cranky survivor is coming
Do
up.
It.
The only thing that I see is that the court itself benefits from endless litigation that is brought forward by domestic violence perpetrators who are trying to enact coercive control. You know, lawyers benefit from it. The court benefits from it monetarily. So how exactly are we going to be able to try to break that cycle of...
I think it's unfair to refer to the court monolithically, because you named lawyers, and I think it's important to break down.
Well, I think
the
ethical standards probably need to be raised,
right,
in the case of you know, lawyers dealing with family law, that currently there is no mandate that lawyers who are engaged with custody and access learn about domestic violence,
right,
even identify domestic violence,
right,
that they are not mandated to look and see if the behaviors and actions of the person who is paying them, right, to harass their victims, they have no skin in the game. And so I think that, you know, if we are going to have this conversation about perpetrator proofing your practice, we are kind of relying on the goodwill and humanity of those engaged in the court and assuming that they're willing to look at these things. But there is no mandate to do so.
Well, I think, again, you have a number of different parties who may be involved. You may have court evaluators. You may have attorneys. Again, in some of these families, a lot of these cases, the parents are representing themselves. So there's not even attorneys involved.
Right.
You know, you've got, you know, lawyers who work for the courts. You've got the judges and magistrates themselves. And in those systems, the government systems are offering to reduce the usage of the system, actually.
Right.
Because they've got a volume and a capacity issue almost in every court I know of.
Right.
That they actually are one of the challenges that they're trying to figure out which case they put the most attention to. And then every lawyer, every judge I've talked to, particularly judges I've spoken to, they want better quality information.
Right.
They want better argued cases. The more this is clear, I haven't run into a judge who says, I want less information. Mm-hmm. They want better information and they want quality information. And so the model, you know, we talk about a perpetrator pattern-based approach. You know, we lawyers and judges really like it because it moves things from generalities to specifics. It moves things, you know, that allows them to better, you know, interrogate the evidence, ask questions of it. Is this valid? And so moving this conversation to behavioral patterns, to moving it to this question of harm, you know, which is more likely to be documented, more likely to be identifiable.
Right.
You know, and measuring it against this kind of collaborative standard of this doesn't fit. In fact, if you show up in my court and you're saying that your client is going to show up in your program, because I think we need more of this kind of attitude.
Right.
You know, if you're going to show up in the court and your client who's got a documented history of domestic violence because this person's been arrested, because their criminal court's been involved, because there's been order of protection against them that's been granted by another court, maybe by me, that if your client doesn't come in and acknowledge what they've done, the harm it's done, and that they're not actively trying to repair it, then you're not going to win, quote unquote, on the custody and access side because this is harmful to kids. And that's what we need as a standard of behavior.
Yeah. I mean, I think about what you said in one of, I don't know if it was on one of the podcasts or if it was just in passing in one of our conversations, but if there was an addiction issue in front of the court in the context of custody and access,
right?
And that person went to an addiction program, but never admitted they had an addiction, never engaged in any type of behavioral change or showed any progress or remorse or willingness to change, the person in charge of that program would go before the judge with documentation and state that. And that would be a matter that would be material to that custody and access.
Right.
Why is it in domestic abuse cases, people can go to behavior change programs, never admit what they did, never acknowledge it, and we say, oh, it's because they have legal issues before the court. Never engage in behaviors which show that they are actually changing their behavior towards their partner or their children and still get custody and access.
And I think it's for a couple of reasons. I think people really believe and understand that addiction and mental health issues belong to that person.
Right.
And have more comfort and familiarity with those issues generally. I think one of the big barriers is they think that the domestic violence is an issue that actually goes away when the couple separates.
Yes, or they don't mutualized understand.
I think it's a fundamental misunderstanding issue, mischaracterization. Mm-hmm. And I think essentially a way to let people who are choosing violence and abuse off the hook.
Right.
You know, because it really says, okay, it's about both people. And like you said earlier, it's about conflict in the couple versus that pattern-based approach. And so I think that we have to tease apart all these things. And you said, I think it is about the training of the lawyers. I think it is about the training of the evaluators.
Right.
Because if the evaluators are giving better opinions back to the, or more accurate assessments of families in these situations back to the court, even judges without training are going to make better decisions. I think that's just sort of, you know, the way the system works. The judges or magistrates are very heavily relying in a lot of cases, not always, sometimes they choose to ignore it, on those expert opinions, on those evaluators, on those,
right,
on the opinion of a guardian ad litem or a psychological evaluator.
If you hand them decontextual information that's not pattern-based.
That's right.
That is incidents-focused.
Right.
There's a high likelihood that you're not going to have a good outcome.
And when mental health and addiction issues for survivors are decontextualized and treated just as mental health issues or addiction diagnoses and treatment,
yes,
by those mental health professionals.
There was recently a great research article that came out. Surprise, surprise, researchers are starting to say that PTSD and other issues caused by trauma are not mental health disorders. They are simply a response to trauma and stimulus. That means that if that continues in an ongoing way, and if systems and professionals back that up, that trauma is heightened. And so, you know, it's incredibly malinformed to use PTSD and other trauma-based diagnoses against a parent to remove custody from them and give custody to the person who caused that.
So going back to...
Sorry, cranky survivor.
No, I love the cranky survivor. And your awareness is so important. Going back to that 8-point kind of framework, which I think helps with both identification and assessment, you know, is again, violence and abuse, coercive control, systems involvement, you know, of somebody to help identify. That's why, you know, you need to use those systems and markers as a way to potentially verify the presence of abuse and the history,
right,
of it. But it's not it's not always there, but you have to ask that question. Looking and considering how the patterns have changed post-separation, you know, what are the concerns about future safety and well-being, and how might somebody be manipulating the court systems? Then that's one area. Then questions about how these issues intersect with mental health and addiction is another area. The culture and context, you know, status, privilege,
right,
you know, with somebody who is a party, is a police officer, that's important. You know, standing in the community.
Somebody who has a partner who has, you know, immigration status, which is questionable.
That's right. All those things are important to be considering, again, because you're thinking through the lens of coercive control, not just physical violence. Then obviously, specific place to look at dangerous and lethality. Is there a reason to believe, particularly moving into the separation, moving into court process, where somebody who's been abusive may not get what they want? You know, we need to ask the question, what do we believe this person is capable and willing to do
if they
the court proceedings
what they want.
Don't go what they want? I mean, this is, to me, it's such a basic question to be asking parties.
It's like dealing with a 2-year-old.
Right.
I'm going to say that over and over again.
Right.
Because behavior modification means that every time that behavior crops up and somebody says no, that we're at a point, a critical point, where that person who's engaging in trying to coerce an outcome is either going to accelerate their behaviors or they will modify their behaviors to fit the expectations that professionals and systems around them place on them. The missing piece here is that our systems have not been engaging in behavioral modification. They have not been saying no.
Well, no, and backing it up and doing it. But even to get there, you need to identify the problem. And I think part of it is that we've done a poor job in a lot of our systems really identifying the problem behaviors,
right,
the things we should be concerned about.
Right.
And again, if you're in a custody and access environment where the concern is just focused on risk of violence, which again, I don't want to minimize. Like, is there risk,
yeah,
of violence, the risk of danger? That is an important conversation, but it can't, again, crowd out or replace or be the only thing. If you don't have a language and a framework to talk about that parent or caregiver who's engaged in abusive behavior and the harm it's created to kids and the context it's created for what's going on in the family and how it's evolving and changing in the family court and manifesting in the family court process, that you're going to be at the mercy of that person.
Yeah.
And the environment they've created in the family, you're not going to identify why this person who has a legitimate claim to X amount of time or X amount of money is coming in and saying, no, I really don't want child support. That's okay. Because you're not saying, they're not saying he's going to kill me. He's not saying I'm going to be abused. They're just saying, what they're saying is,
I don't want to deal with this.
I don't want to deal with the risk to myself or my kids.
I would rather walk away and have nothing
well,
than deal with this.
That's right. And my ex-partner, I know if I ask for child support, is going to demand things of me.
Right.
And the kids, and it's going to hurt my kids and possibly put myself in danger. So I'm going to acquiesce before the fact. And I think, you know, our system's set up to help that person identify it. And again, like perpetrator proof and say, no, we're not going to necessarily let you go into mediation. We're not going to let you in those circumstances. Right. And it may not be the danger of physical violence, but we're not going to let you go in there and let this person get their way and your kids to suffer. We are going to talk to you about safety, and we're going to put this matter in front of a judge. And we're going to look at, you know, could you be safe if there was an order of child support, you know, and partner with you
around those things. And can you be safe in the context of custody and having to send your children to somebody and then have that contact with them?
Right.
Have that forced contact with them.
Right.
Is that safe for your children and for you?
And the last thing is, I think these things have been separated out. That eighth factor is there a history or pattern of child abuse and neglect? And I think, again, historically, for those of you who haven't listened before, you know that the model really tries to connect up patterns of domestic violence with patterns of child abuse and neglect, because that person who's often engaging in one is more likely to be engaging in the other. And I think we've done a disservice to families.
And I'd really like to reiterate that when we say child abuse, because I think that people still associate child abuse with just physical violence, that again, we don't just mean physical violence.
Right.
We don't just mean that person's going to break their child's arm and therefore they're a bad parent.
Right.
That means that person is engaging in the same behaviors of coercive control, demeaning, verbal abuse, emotional abuse, potentially sexual abuse, all of these different things, which basically are habituating that child to believing that is normal parenting, the court allowing that to happen, again, tells that child that our society believes that that's okay. And they grow up believing that that's the way that relationships are.
Right.
And then we throw our hands up in the air and say, oh, hey, why is domestic violence so prevalent?
Right.
It's because we're not engaging in behavioral modification and drawing boundaries, firm and clear boundaries with people who are being abusive and saying you may not have access to your children if you are going to harm them in these ways and teach them that this is okay.
Right.
And really, I think, also, one of the things that needs to be acknowledged, particularly when it comes down to cultural issues, to religious issues, that we are still living in a society where there are plenty of people involved in the systems who believe that abuser has a right to mandate those things, that they have a right to use the courts to compel their partner to bring their children to church in the way that they want to.
Right.
Or that they have a right to compel their partner not to engage in certain types of relationships. This is sanctioned coercive control.
Well, and it's not just the courts. I mean, I think it's, and we've done this
in child protection.
We've done child protection too. I've been thinking about child protection related evaluation, which told this domestic violence victim that she shouldn't engage in a relationship for a year. And this is, you know, I specifically I wanted to highlight today for the first part of this episode, the gender neutral nature of this conversation.
Right.
I really did. And this is neutral on gender. It's neutral on sexual orientation. That the core, and if you want, you can reference our paper on the gender paradox at the heart of the safety of the model. Right. You know, I'll kind of put the link to that on the show notes. But there's so much of the model that is about just about behavior.
Right.
And that behavior is not about the gender or the sexual orientation of the person who's doing it.
Right.
You know, or the culture, or the class, the background. It's really just about behaviors. And it's as those of you who've listened and know the model also know, it's impossible for me, at least, to not talk about the gendered nature of these issues, because mm-hmm. I think this idea that you can tell somebody who they, like an evaluator, could feel comfortable saying to a mother, you shouldn't be in a relationship with a man for a year to focus on kids. I have a really hard time believing they would say the same thing to a man.
Right.
And I think we have to look at why these allegations, when again in the context of gender, why addiction allegations against mothers, why mental health addictions allegations against mothers, mm-hmm. why they end up carrying so much weight in these systems,
right.
is because that differing standard we have about mothers and fathers.
Well,
that really permeates all these systems.
So I think that we've done a real disservice to men, and it's been worked into our narratives around men. We basically engaged in a caveman version of what men are, and that is very binary. Testosterone is the adjutant. You are biologically aggressive and unconcerned with other people's well-being because you're a man. People who engage in that type of assumption, which is incorrect, testosterone has been shown over and over again to not cause violence. It's not the causal piece. Entitlement is the causal piece. If you feel entitled, if you've been told that you're entitled,
right.
to have these things,
right.
to behave this way,
to rape, to beat, to harm, to demean. For a long time, the narrative was that abuse or violent behavior is tied to low self-esteem. And then when you read the literature, and I don't think you see this actually very much anymore, but because it was so invalid, is that people who are engaging in violence, and this was in a lot of different settings, often had an overinflated sense of themselves. And if you start thinking about that, how that overinflated, unrealistic sense of themselves, their capacities, their rights to things, you begin to see how vulnerable that makes them to mm-hmm. being unstable. Mm-hmm. Because if their expectations on themselves and the world's reaction to them is so unrealistic,
right.
that therefore it's constantly being challenged.
Yeah.
And your choices, if you believe your own narrative of how great you are,
right.
then your choices at that point are, it's either I'm not that great, wow, I've got to really look at myself, or all of you are wrong, right. and you're out to get me. And we see that over and over again in lots of settings in the world.
It's so interesting when you get down to it, because a lot of professionals don't talk about the specificity of these behaviors. They don't engage in laying out the specificity of these behaviors. But, you know, you have a domestic abuser who uses their body language to intimidate and frighten their family into compliance. Oftentimes, that domestic abuser feels that that is their right to do, that this is what's called discipline.
Right.
Because they've been told that that's discipline.
Right.
Because they experienced it growing up. And they believe that it's the way to discipline, and they get such good results from it.
So I think part of it is this idea that collaborative parenting, it should be put side by side with the patterns of people who are choosing abuse, I think is a way to really help systems rebalance about the way they think about men and engage men. Because I'm always a proponent that we need to get better at understanding how father's choices and behaviors matter to child and family functioning, including in the custody and access setting.
Right.
And that there are a tremendous number of men who are deeply engaged in a constructive way with their children.
Right.
And they care about them, and they care about them post-separation, and they're involved.
And they're engaged in nurturing ways They are engaged in their day-to-day life.
That's right.
They take them to the doctor.
That's right. That's right.
They take them to school.
That's right.
They make them lunch.
That's right.
They make them dinner. They put them to bed.
That's right.
They read them books.
That's right.
All of these things that men are also responsible for.
And I think when we
are not being seen.
Are not being seen. And because when the argument gets framed as a right to access.
Right.
Versus as a looking at the behaviors of parenting, which is what kids need us to do.
Right.
Kids need us to keep our focus on how are they being treated, mm-hmm. not who has a right to them.
Right.
That's what kids need. Kids need systems. And if we're going to inoculate our systems against people choosing violence,
we have to end the notion that people have a right to access if they're abusive, if their behaviors are abusive.
Well, and I think it's, again, if you think through the lens of the voices of children, that kids need us. So I'm speaking to all the professionals in the systems to keep our focus on how they're being treated. It's a no-brainer. And so our conversations about custody and access are not about patterns of treatment. We're missing something.
I don't believe in the context and history of the court that it is a no-brainer.
Right.
I believe that children have been treated as commodities, that they have been treated as if they are property within the family court context. And that, you know, if you grew up in very conservative circles, as I did, children are a commodity.
Right.
You have as many as you can, right? You're raising an army for another purpose. And you do treat children as if they're commodities instead of assessing behaviorally how you are nurturing them, how you are sustaining them, how you are teaching them to be good human beings. They must comply.
And
they must do as they're told.
Right. And I think that when we talk about inoculating your system against perpetrators or abusers and them trying to manipulate custody and access proceedings to weaponize their children, to use those mm-hmm. proceedings against their partner mm-hmm. to punish them or to threaten them or to hurt them or to control them, mm-hmm. you know, that we have to first identify and assess those patterns of behavior. We have to recontextualize what's going on and what we're seeing in our courts or in evaluations around that. If we're not getting that information, if we're doing a psychological or psychosocial evaluation or interactive evaluation in the context of custody and evaluation, and we don't have information about patterns of coercive control, historical behaviors, we haven't either seen how those connect to harm to kids and child and family functioning, or we're not doing that assessment ourselves, then there's much more of a chance that we're going to end up being victims of that perpetrator ourselves. And I'm really going to I'm pleading with my professional colleagues to really say and look at this, because if your training hasn't prepared you for this, if your training hasn't really included looking at coercive control, if your training hasn't really looked at intersections between domestic violence perpetration and mental health and addiction, if your training hasn't actually gotten you to look at patterns of coercive control post-separation, then you are more vulnerable than you can be or than you should be.
And you're probably also, unfortunately, creating documentation which is not in the survivor's best interest or their children.
The adult or child survivor's best interest. And I think that for me, that we have the knowledge and the technology at this point to really reduce the way perpetrators manipulate custody and access. We know what's needed. We know that we're nowhere near that parental alienation shouldn't be the focus of conversation.
Well, I think that the focus should shift in parental alienation to looking at who's truly alienating, and that would be the person who's choosing to abuse their ex-partner and their children and manipulate court systems around them in order to alienate that protective parent from the children.
And I don't see at this point, I think that the word alienation is so fraught.
Yes.
That even in the context which I understand that you're using, that makes sense.
Right.
it's such a hair trigger for so many people.
It is.
That we have to really reframe the conversation back to this one about that the standard of parenting that we're looking for is collaborative, and apply it in that way where we say, when somebody has acted in a pattern of course control, they have fundamentally stepped away from
collaborative parenting,
yep. And that we can't even form an opinion about that other parent in any meaningful way until this is contextualized and this is understood and this is addressed, because that's so pervasive in its impact that if we just we need to keep going back to patterns of course control is the antithesis of collaborative parenting. And therefore, what flows from that antithesis is often going to be harmful to the child and the function of the family. And in fact, is not going to be where the court wants to end up unless it's addressed by that parent who's engaged in that non-collaborative, coercively controlling behavior historically. Mm-hmm. And that has to be the primary focus.
And there should be a level of simplicity to it. Here's the patterns of behaviors which show that this person is impeding collaborative co-parenting and is engaging in harmful behaviors, right? Change it. Show me you've changed it. Show me you've changed
right.
it.
Right.
Show, acknowledge it.
Right.
Show me you've acknowledged
well,
it.
Well, that's that again.
Turn to the co-parent. Say, has this gotten better?
Right.
Is this person still threatening you?
Right.
How is it when you have to switch custody?
Right.
What's the temperament of this person? Right. Are they engaging in harming collaborative co-parenting? Right. Are they causing problems where problems do not exist?
That's right. And so I would say, you know, and that we'll reference the paper also about perpetrator intervention program certificates are dangerous, references this kind of rubric that you're talking about, right. about how to measure change. But what I want to say, and then we may need to start wrapping up because it's a huge topic.
I know, we could talk about this for hours.
Yeah, is that people have said to me, well, the safety of the mother talks about partnering, and courts are
neutral.
Need to be neutral and objective.
They're
okay,
definitely
impartial.
Not neutral when they come down with a judgment.
Well, that's right. So part of it is what I say to those folks is that the safety of the model was designed, actually, its behavioral focus was meant to be applied in an impartial, objective way. It was very specific.
Right.
Because it was brought into or developed in the context of government child protection systems that I was very aware needed. And I'm a believer in due process. I'm a believer in objectivity. I'm a believer in impartiality. I really am. I think those things are so critical for governments and professionals to operate the way they're supposed to. And so this was like, here's a behavioral lens to put on what's in front of you.
Right.
To really do the best and most comprehensive assessment possible. And then if we're going to follow the facts that are derived from that lens, mm-hmm. and that we have a mandate that is around child safety, which is often very present in the custody and access arena, is often present in the child safety arena, obviously, mm-hmm. that at some point, and you've identified a parent who's engaged in harmful behavior and a parent who's engaged in protective behaviors, then given your mandate to child safety, mm-hmm. the perspective of the court is often going to align with the perspective of the protective parent.
It should.
And that's right. And therefore, this idea of with issuing, like you just said, issuing an order, is taking a position.
It is
taking a side, is making a decision, is making a finding.
A criminal judgment is not impartial.
That's right. It's right. Well, that's right. Exactly. And I think it's really important to understand that you want impartiality and neutrality and transparency in the way you get to your decision.
Right.
But your decision picks sides.
You need the best information, the clearest information, the most contextual information possible.
That's right.
To get to that place.
To get that place. And so if we side, well, there are good people on both sides. We've heard that recently said in the last couple of years. There's good people on both sides. But when that applies to somebody who's doing harm and somebody who's protecting, then that's actually out of alignment with the mission of the courts
right.
and systems entrusted for safety of kids.
Right.
And so you get to say, we actually are in alignment with this protective parent over here. That's not out of alignment
because with... this protective parent over here is not criminal.
Right.
Because this protective parent over here isn't engaging in assassinating collaborative co-parenting, which is the measure of the court. Mm-hmm. Because this protective parent over here is nurturing to the well-being of their children's and their children's safety. And that parent over there is not.
Right.
There must be a dividing line. There must be a place where the court is able to say our mission is best interest of children. Therefore, we must assess.
Right.
We should assess coercive control and domestic violence to ascertain whether or not children are
safe. And it's okay to come
safe.
Down on the side of that protective parent, because coming down the side of that protective parent in a decision is coming down the side of the kids and the safety of the kids. And I think we need to get more comfortable with that. And anytime I explain that partnering language and those behavioral steps, nobody who raises objection about impartiality and neutrality has a problem with it. They all go, that makes sense.
Right.
I think there's a fear, and I'm back to gender here for a second. There's a fear that, that in doing this, that they'll be accused of being biased against men. And I think it's really important that we need to really kind of acknowledge that systems do need to do a better job behaviorally assessing men's roles in the lives of their kids, valuing the role of men's good behavior in the lives of their kids, and identifying men's bad fathering behavior. Separate from a discussion around just it's about gender or it's about this, it's about behavior.
Right. And the same is true for women as well.
That's right.
The same behavioral framework applies to women as well, which is why it's very frustrating when that takes over the conversation, which is intentional, I think. It's intentional to distract away from behavior.
Because I think it becomes framed as a rights issue.
Right.
I want to be clear to people that when you're having a rights conversation, you're not having a behavior conversation.
You're not having a conversation about safety.
And I think that's part of what you're saying. And it's, we're not having a child safety conversation.
Right.
So we're actually looking at putting at the forefront child safety and the rights of the children to be safe in a post-separation
environment.
And we're looking at the way to do that, to identify, assess, and inoculate is by really understanding patterns of coercive control and the harm they do to child, partner, and
family. Part of understanding those patterns of post-separation coercive control is actually incredibly important to understand how people who are coercively controlling manipulate systems as part of that and documenting that.
Right.
If that person has made false allegations, multiple times in child protection against their co-parent, that should be documented.
Right.
As harassment.
That's harassment. That's right. And I think we're one of the things.
And harm to children.
And we keep saying we're going
to end. And harm to children, because that's traumatic. Having an open child protection case where child protection has to come and interview your family and you have to be interviewed as a child is incredibly traumatic.
Right.
Why would any loving parent put their child through that?
That's right. And I think I think we need to name these things and be clear about them. And we're seeing, as we've added systems of manipulation into our mapping tool, soon to be software. Selling software, a little plug for our coming mapping software.
Yes.
And we've been working a lot of technology stuff.
Map those
stuff.
Patterns. Course
control
patterns.
Toolkit, mapping software. 2022 is going to be the year of technology and tools for us. That the more we put that into our tools, the more professionals are coming back to us saying, we're getting better identifying this and it's paying off.
Right.
Because while some of this is pretty, insidious,
and expect a pushback.
That's right.
We expect a pushback.
Some of this is insidious. Some of it is actually hiding in plain sight. And then once you have the language for it, you actually can name it. And people go, oh, wow.
Wow.
I didn't think about that way. And let's put it together. Okay. So we are wrapping up this episode, our first one in about a month. It's so great to be back.
It is.
And we were really worried that Tiberius the dog was going to be a problem, and
he did change positions once,
but he's been quiet and he's resting, and it was lovely to have him here. And you've been listening to Partner with a Survivor. And I'm David Mandel, the Executive Director of the Safe and Together Institute.
And I'm Ruth Stearns Mandel. And if you would like to hear more episodes, please go to our website, safeandtogetherinstitute.com. If you would like to engage in training or free or paid training and become more domestic violence informed in your context, no matter what system you work in, you can go to academy.safeandtogetherinstitute.com. And there is a mixture of free and paid training. And we have our new partnering course out, Partnering with Survivors. 3 years in the making is out now.
Yes.
And you will get 15% off if you use the coupon code PARTNERED, all lowercase.
That's right. And we, of course, walks you through 6 steps that really kind of help you think about what's involved, the skills involved with partnering. So I think on that note,
we're out.
We're out. Thank you.